Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Computers, iPods, iPads, cell phones, DVD players, the list of technological gadgetry goes on. And the problem is they all eventually wear out or are replaced by the next big thing. So what do we do with the remains of the day and age of technology? Journalist Alex Howard wrote about e-waste and e-cycling for Tech Republic. He joins us now. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Pleasure to join you.
Why are electronics not disposable by way of the landfill like everything else?
Well, it has to do with the things that are inside of them. The silicon, the plastic that you think of constituting much of these devices isn't necessarily toxic, but a lot of the rare earths that are inside of them are. And that goes from everything from metals to, in particular, the batteries that are inside of them. Everyone knows you shouldn't put batteries in fire or open them up for very good reasons. You'll have it.
Alex, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We need to call you right back.
Okay.
I'm going to take questions from our listeners. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We need to reestablish that connection with Alex Howard. He is a journalist for Tech Republic. He's written about e-waste and e-cycling. If you have a question about what to do with your electronics, give us a call. Maybe we can talk about that. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do you have three computers stacked up in your office like I do? Are you holding on to them because you don't know what to do about the data that's stored on them? Give us a call and maybe Alex can respond to your questions. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about how the chemicals and the metals and so forth are safe to use in these devices, but they're not safe to store in landfills. The way they break down is unsafe to the environment. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. Coming up later in the show, we're going to be talking about countries in Africa are bypassing the United States in the use of technology and making payments. In some cases in Kenya, almost $35 million per day flow through the electronic payment system known as M-Pesa. That's pretty much eliminating the need for a bank account there. What do you make of that? 614-292-8513 if you have a question about that coming up later on. And then, of course, we'll have DeepGeek.com's tech blogger Russell Holly with us. He'll be talking about a new charging device that claims it will charge your devices up to 90% faster. That's certainly important to a lot of us. Once again, 614-292-8513. We're still trying to get back with Alex Howard. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. 614-292-8513. I'm waiting to take calls for when Alex Howard is here so he can answer the questions. We're still trying to get him back. We may not get him back. Let's hear from John in Columbus now. Hi, John. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I really like your program a lot, and I call in once in a while.
Thanks, John. Even though we're going through a little glitch right now.
I know it happens. I'm a tech guy. I understand that. But I have an old Macintosh 2 computer that years ago I did genealogy things on and stored pictures and copies of documents and things like that. I have not turned it on for about 12 years, so it's an old computer, and it's got old stuff in it as far as batteries and things like that. Once I get stuff off of it, I don't know how to do that. But once I do get the stuff off of it, what would be the best way to recycle, I suppose, that old machine?
That is what we're going to talk about. Let's see if we can get Alex Howard. I'm going to have to let you go, though, John. We'll get to that question when we get Alex Howard back on the line. Okay, Alex, are you there?
I think I am.
That's a little bit better.
Okay, good.
You have no idea.
Enjoying the wonders of
modern technology, right?
Well, that's right. So that's a pretty good place to end the conversation. I think a lot of people are struggling with this exact question. I have an old machine. How do I get the things off of it that I want? Make sure that there's something that's precious to me that would be private information I don't want someone else to get. And then where do I take it to recycle it? And there are e-cycling centers in many parts of the U.S., at least. The EPA has been taking steps to make it so you can figure that out. Often local municipalities have specific days of the month when you're supposed to put out your old appliances, electronics, et cetera. And, the one I see a lot and for years moving up in Massachusetts and now in Washington, D.C., is people leaving out monitors and televisions, and then they don't move because they're toxic and they need to be properly disposed of. Often the local city will let you know where you can take them or when you should put them out, how you should flag them. Sometimes you're supposed to put in a 311 request. They know there's something that should be taken away. Generally, the municipalities vary a fair bit in how progressive or how active they are in terms of engaging people about this. But I think as more and more e-waste grows, and this is something that every household now has with an old cell phone at minimum, that they're going to need to continue to get even better about the procedures here and tell the public that it's a public health issue and one that they need their help in preventing moving into the environment where there's a significant problem that gets into landfills or regular trash dumps leaching into the groundwater.
Okay, John, thanks a lot for that call. 614-292-8513 if you have a question. You write that over the past 5 years, an estimated 49 million tons of e-waste has been produced. Could you explain where you come up with that number?
Well, I had a hard time tracking that down. I actually looked at the government data, the research there, and the independent research. There's a number of different advocacy organizations that are trying to estimate. And that's actually the best guess for the annual amount, not the aggregate. There are some estimates that put us producing as a global mass of humanity dozens of tons of this stuff now. And that's when we include larger objects, things that we have known for some time that may be toxic, like appliances, which, of course, weigh a great deal more than cell phones and tablets and the like, which are now just by themselves, constituting a huge amount of mass.
Earl in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Earl. Hello, Earl.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So I am an independent local computer consultant, and I have a couple of options for your Central Ohio listeners. There is a place near downtown called Community Computer Alliance. That is a local nonprofit that takes in your e-waste for you. There's also a place on Morse Road, Ohio Recycling, that will take your e-waste as well and recycle it properly.
Okay.
If they're really interested, they can contact me and I can handle it for them as well.
All right. Well, Earl, I'm going to stick with the first two ideas. Thank you so much for them.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye. There is something called the Green Electronics Challenge. It involves the United States and China. It's a joint initiative. Tell us about that, Alex.
Sure. So the Chinese have a huge challenge on their hands, very similar to the one we have. They've got a rapidly industrialized society, and they're making jumps, from one technology generation to the next. And they're also moving from an agrarian society to a post-industrial one in many ways, which means that they want access to a lot of the same kinds of technologies that we do here, but may not be able to afford them in the same way. So the big idea here is giving people a way not just to e-cycle, right, to take the e-waste and properly dispose of it, but to challenge people to tinker with things in a way that helps them be upcycled, which is to say, use the parts, use the older electronics, which still may be quite useful,
in a way that allows more people to use used ones as opposed to old ones. It's an effort by a number of nonprofits, think tanks, universities, to try to galvanize more people to think creatively about how to use older electronics in ways that allows them to be used by more people, to use less energy, to be manufactured less expensively, and to, in general, be more creative about it. It's tapping into what's been popularly called the maker movement over the last decade or so, something I was associated with in my last job at O'Reilly Media, where Make Magazine and Dale Doherty and Maker Faire, which is an event where people who tinker with things come together and try to be more creative about actually creating things. you know, there's I think, a real need now. It's pretty clear, however, for people not just to be makers, but to be fixers. If you've ever had something break that's quite precious to you, that has precious things on it, which I think defines cell phones and laptops and tablets for many people now, then you know how important it is to be able to fix it and to maintain it. And I think that this is a distributed approach to try to use people in both China and across the U.S. and indeed around the world. It's not a barrier geographically, but just happens to be a cooperation between people in both countries. Try to be more thoughtful about building and specifically rebuild.
Well, have they come up with anything cool?
I think so. You know, I'm going to wait till the contest finishes, but I'm already seeing some designs which suggesting people can power things with less juice, that they can basically get the equipment to keep lasting for longer. And you know, that's a perfectly reasonable thing. I happen to be using a fairly new iPhone right now to talk to you, but I have a first-generation one and a third-generation one, both of which with some rehabbing, can and will be used by family members and friends. And there's hundreds of millions of other devices like that around the world that can be similarly repurposed.
Let's get another idea from David in Columbus. You have an idea about e-cycling? Welcome. Hi, David.
Are you talking about I'm from Pataskala. I'm not sure if I'm the person you were.
You're the man, but it says Columbus.
Okay.
Us bad. Okay. So what's your idea?
Well, I belong to the Licking County Computer Society. It's a computer users group based in Newark. And twice a year, we normally have a recycling drive and collect computers and peripherals.
Okay.
And some of that equipment also gets refurbished and then made available to people who might not otherwise be able to afford a new computer.
Okay.
I believe there's also, I've heard there's some organization in Granville that has a recycling drive.
And okay. Well, when is the Licking County one?
The last one just happened recently. Well, near the end of April.
Okay.
And the next one will probably be in September.
So there's lots of options out there for people if they're looking for a way to get rid of it. David, thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Alex Howard, I want to thank you. Sorry for the confusion at the beginning, but thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. It's great to see you have such great, engaged listeners.
Yep. They've got lots of ideas, that's for sure, and they saved me again today.
Awesome.
All right. Take care, Alexander Howard. He's a journalist for Tech Republic. He's written about e-waste and e-cycling. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Some people might be familiar with MasterCard's PayPass or Visa's PayWave, Google Wallet, or even Bitcoin. They are familiar, if not necessarily popular, modes of payment here. But in Kenya, almost $35 million per day flow through the electronic pay system known as M-Pesa. Now it's starting to catch on in other countries in the region. Joining us is author and journalist Dayo Olapade. She's calling from New York. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Adam.
So in a recent article for TheAtlantic.com, you wrote about how the obstacles facing Africa allowed, as far as the computer age went, allowed entrepreneurs there to beat the West at reinventing money for the mobile age. How did obstacles make it easier for Africa in this regard?
Right. Well, I mean, I always say that if necessity is the mother of invention, then, you know, Africa is the mother of necessity. And so you had an environment where you had an all-cash economy, very little access to finance. Very few mortgages, very few credit cards in Kenya, but as of the last 10 years, almost everyone has a cell phone. And so people were trading airtime back and forth. People were trying to find ways to participate in, you know, the global financial economy. And so it was really these barriers that created the mobile money service known as M-Pesa. I think in the U.S., we might never have dreamed up this idea of using cell phones as a way to send money back and forth, but it was one of the few resources that most of the population had. And so it was a really natural fit in a country where there are only 2,500 ATMs for 40 million people.
How does it work? What happens?
Well, when I was living in Kenya for about 2 years, I would take cash and go to a teller. This wasn't a traditional teller at a brick-and-mortar bank, but just a guy with a cell phone who's a registered agent of the telecom, Safaricom. And I would give him the money. He would put it in my account. He would load it. And so my balance would show up on my cell phone. I would have, let's say, $20. And so I could send that money to anyone else on the network. Think about that. Just anyone with a cell phone number, you could send them 50 cents. You could send them $5. You could receive money, and you could keep a balance there. So obviously for me, this was great for settling dinner bills. It was cool for, you know, paying a taxi driver if I didn't have cash on me. But for many people in Kenya who were trying to send money to relatives who could be hundreds of kilometers away or had no place to store money other than, you know, a mattress, this was totally revolutionary. And it was just within a couple of months, it was already had a couple of million users. And now it's almost 86% of households in Kenya have an M-Pesa account. So it has just exploded. And as you mentioned, it's not just in Kenya, but in many other countries in Africa where you have the same problem with the cash economy, no bank accounts, no credit, and cell phones everywhere. So it's really become a transformative solution all across the continent.
How has it changed life there?
Well, as I said, you know, it's made it easier for people to have financial lives. People who are worried about storing money in a coffee can or in a hole in the ground or in a mattress were able to have some security and to, in some ways, save. Because I think when you have cash, you're so liquid that it can be more difficult to prioritize to save all the things that we know are important for financial stability.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big difference there. And it also just allowed people to lower transaction costs. People used to have to stand in line at the post office to pay their electricity bill or their water bill. I certainly used to do that in Kenya. Now you can just text your money to, you know, the cable company right over the phone. So that saves people the hassle of, you know, traveling to the place, waiting in line. And for many people who are not wealthy, losing half a day is like losing, you know, half a day of wages. And that was really problematic.
So the businesses have gotten in on it, too, then.
Yes, I think there are all across sub-Saharan Africa businesses that are trying to support more complicated products, not just, you know, money, mobile-to-mobile transfer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, Kopo Kopo in Kenya, tries to get merchants to accept this. It used to be just the big utilities, the cable, water, electricity companies, and individuals. Now they're trying to get, you know, mom-and-pop merchants to have a way to accept money. Because obviously it was only cash before, and many of these merchants are not using MasterCard or Visa accounts, for goodness sake. So this is a way for the sort of small business class to participate in this mobile money economy.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Daya Olapade. She's an author and journalist, and we're talking about the M-Pesa system. It started in Kenya. It was really started out of necessity because things we take for granted in the United States, ATMs, computers, banks on every street corner, along with churches, it seems like. That's not the case in Kenya or in much of many of the countries in Africa. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's not necessarily an identification system other than the phone number attached to the device. Is security an issue? Has that been a problem?
Well, there is actually a PIN number associated with your account. There are two PINs for receiving and for making transfers. Mm-hmm. So there is some level of security. I think the telecom who is operating in Kenya, and it does vary from African country to country, mm-hmm. Has instituted the same sort of know your customer anti-money laundering policies as do traditional banks. But because it's a telecom, it's not a bank. And I think that's been a very interesting dynamic. Here in the U.S., I don't think we would ever see this kind of innovation, which has really changed lives, because we have these very, very regulated industries like telecoms and banks that will never really be allowed to merge in this inventive way, which is a shame. I think I would love to be able to send money through my phone. There are some apps that do that in the U.S., obviously, mm-hmm. but from a security standpoint, it's been very low instances of fraud, and I think the benefits clearly outweigh any concerns over that in sub-Saharan Africa.
So how many people, you said, what percentage of the people in Kenya have cell phones now?
Oh, gosh. The figure, you know, I wrote a book called The Bright Continent, which folks can check out for more of these stories about innovation in Africa. Mm-hmm. And at the time I started writing the book, the figure for cell phones all across sub-Saharan Africa was about 450 million people. By the time the book came to print this spring, the figure is now 720 million people. So the figures just keep climbing. As I think many families and individuals are realizing that this is one of the most essential tools. It's the first screen. In an environment where there are not a lot of landline telephones, I never used a landline when I was living in Nairobi, mm-hmm. and where access to more complicated computing devices like a PC is still constrained, the cell phone becomes this incredibly valuable tool. And this goes back to the idea of necessity, driving invention. When your cell phone is, you know, the most complicated, most expensive piece of technology you own, you need your cell phone to do more. You need your cell phone to work as a bank. You need your cell phone to communicate with people, mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. And so the benefits of cell phone ownership across sub-Saharan Africa has been just astronomical. It's considered to contribute about 0.1% of GDP growth for every couple hundred million cell phones that are online, which is really remarkable. And I think speaks to this, what they call leapfrogging, in all across sub-Saharan Africa, where instead of going through the first and second generation of technologies that we've now abandoned, mm-hmm. they're starting, you know, at 3.0, version 3.0, which I think is very exciting and important.
Are these smartphones necessarily, or just basic cell phones that text?
It definitely varies. Mm-hmm. Smartphone adoption is also increasing at an astronomical clip. But it's still only a fraction of the numbers, that $720 million figure. One of the exciting things that I've seen beyond just mobile money, which is a story that many people already know, is the evolution of the mobile phone and the mobile technology industry in East Africa in particular. So you're seeing technology companies, Huawei, which is a Chinese handset manufacturer, came into the Kenyan market with a smartphone under $100 for the first time. And that was 2 years ago. Now smartphones are pricing at about $50 or $60, which is imminently affordable for, you know, an emerging consumer class all across sub-Saharan Africa. So you're seeing competition drive the price of these handsets down. And they're doing that because data is so much more valuable to sell to consumers than just voice and text. So the companies see value in getting smartphones into the hands of consumers. Consumers see value because they can participate in more complicated sort of technological functions with smartphones. And so there's this nice marriage of interests that are accelerating the rate of adoption of smartphones all across sub-Saharan Africa.
It's very, very cool. It makes me wonder about education, too, how much it could help with education. I mean, textbooks could be on a smartphone.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think there are all kinds of different products and services that can be served up when you have computing power on a smartphone. I think you're seeing some of those models on things like Kindles and other e-readers, mm-hmm. And I've seen those deployed, and there are a couple of stories about that in my book. But more generally, I think what's interesting in the financial inclusion space is you are seeing not just text money to, you know, another, to a friend. You're seeing more complicated financial products being built on top of mobile money.
Like what?
And this is not just in Kenya. Well, you have insurance, for example. Hmm. When you have the agricultural economy is still really big. There's lots and lots of farmers in East Africa and Africa in general. And so when you want to sell an insurance product to a farmer in case their crops fail, it was often really hard to figure out how to get the payments to the farmers. Now, you can sign up for insurance and be paid out automatically in the case of a rain shortfall, for example. Insurance is also been used for pregnant women who obviously have, they know in advance that they're going to have medical costs that might be higher than normal. And so they're able to insure themselves and pay and receive, pay premiums and receive reimbursement using their phone. I think that's really exciting. We mentioned merchants being allowed to use mobile money, which is an important intervention in the commercial economy. And you're also seeing, I think, what's really, really transformative, sort of access to credit mm-hmm. and building sort of rudimentary credit reporting schemes. Because you can imagine a world in which, you know, there are no credit cards, very few mortgages, big banks do not take seriously these consumers who they consider to be too poor to have savings accounts, too poor to have checking accounts, not worth bothering with. Mm-hmm. You're seeing these third parties come in and say, listen, we know this person keeps a mobile money balance of, let's say, $200. We know that they add money with this amount of frequency. We know that they have this kind of spending habits. We can say that they're, you know, a low risk for access to finance. So I love that, you know, people who are otherwise invisible to the traditional commercial banks are suddenly on the radar and able to have more complicated financial lives with more security and more convenience and greater technology than ever before. I think that's one of the really most amazing things about mobile money is that it's not standing still. It's evolving every day to provide better services for African consumers.
What about wages?
Well, I mean, I think that many employers can pay wages using mobile money. And I think that's, again, a lot easier than doing it in cash, a lot easier than doing it in banks. And I should say that the informal sector in sub-Saharan Africa is in some countries up to 70% of the economy. When I say informal, I mean folks who are working as carpenters or seamstresses or masons or, you know, kiosk workers, but who are not part of a formally incorporated company with regular payroll and all of that. Mm-hmm. And so when there's such a high proportion of folks being paid in cash for inconsistent work, or it's not always clear, you know, they might do seasonal work in one part of the country and then come and do a job in the city for another part of the year. To be able to track these folks, to be able to have electronic payments that can support this person rather than having insecure cash for all the reasons I mentioned before mm-hmm. is really transformative. And for employers to be able to manage workers despite not having all of the trappings of a formal registered business is another important for accounting and just for organizational purposes, innovation.
You said earlier that you didn't see it necessarily, this concept merging with how we manage money in the United States because we have an entrenched and highly regulated banking system here. What is the government of Kenya? What are their observations of this? Is this a way to tax? Is this something that they are looking at regulating?
Well, there are, I think one of the best things about this innovation, particularly in Kenya, is how much the government sort of stood back and got out of the way. Hmm. They understood that innovation does not necessarily come from the public sector mm-hmm. in so many different ways in sub-Saharan Africa, whether it's for health or energy or education. There are lots and lots of private actors coming up with great innovations that, you know, the government might not have the capacity to support. And so in this case, the Kenyan government stood back, allowed telecom to operate as a deposit-taking quasi-financial institution for 4 or 5 years before there were fees, obviously, per transaction. very small ones for the M-Pesa customers, but taxing these organizations, regulating them, instituting capital controls did not happen really until 2013. So there really was an understanding that this could be transformative. It needed oxygen to breathe so that it could scale, so it could reach more and more Kenyans who needed, you know, financial services. And I think that's one of the most commendable things that the government of Kenya and the Central Bank of Kenya have done. In other countries in Africa, I'll use Nigeria as an example, the central bank has, and the government in general, has been much more suspicious and much, having seen what happened in Kenya, much more interested in controlling the system to try and extract rent, to try and make sure that they were getting a cut. And I think in those countries, you see less adoption and less innovation and less of these amazing, you know, transformative services for people. And so I think there's a really strong relationship between the level of government ownership and the amount of change you're able to see in the lives of people. And so, you know, I think in general, it's been good for the government to stand back and allow these things to grow instead of strangling them in the cradle.
Who came up with this anyways? Was it one of the utilities, you said, or?
Right. So it's actually a fun. I mean, people can read the article in The Atlantic and people can read my book for much more information about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the short story is that folks, you know, were already trying to figure out ways to have to solve problems in the face of this cash economy, informality, no access to finance. So people were spending airtime minutes back and forth. It would be like, I'll send you 5 minutes of airtime if you give me a lift, or I'll send you 10 minutes of talk time if you give me, you know, this good, or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
But there was already a tradition of using phones to send minutes, and it was an investment from a 500,000 pound investment from DFID, the UK aid agency, plus the backing of Vodacom, the parent of Safaricom, the local telecom. So it's kind of a public-private partnership that decided to try it with money. And it was a really small pilot, and people immediately understood what was going on. They were like, aha! And so it was a mixture of ordinary people who were already trying to solve problems and a very smart, pretty lean investment from a public-private partnership that allowed this to grow to the scale you have seen. Where, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, $35 million a day is being transacted over this service. So it's really been just incredible. And it's a shame we don't have it in America.
Well, thank you for joining us today to talk about it. Her new book is entitled The Bright Continent, Breaking Rules and Making Change in Modern Africa. Daya Olopade, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anne. Have a great day.
You too. Daya Olopade, she's an author and journalist coming up. Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. That's Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We have some breaking news. Microsoft has lowered the price of Xbox significantly. Joining us now to talk about that and more, Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks.
So what's this all about? What's Microsoft done and why do we care?
So for a while now, the Xbox One has been about $100 more than the PlayStation 4. They were both announced at just about the same time, and they have really similar features. The PlayStation 4 is actually in some ways more powerful than the Xbox One, which kind of confused a lot of people because the Microsoft, you know, version of this game console was more expensive. But now it's not. They've dropped the price. They just announced that starting on June 9th, the price in all of the stores that the Xbox One is sold in will be dropped to $399. And to accomplish this price, they've removed the Xbox Kinect, the camera with the microphone. So just like the Xbox 360, it'll be sold as a separate unit that they haven't given a price to yet, but I assume it'll be $99 to make the price difference. But now, starting June 9th, the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4 will be the same price.
Was it just that by removing the Kinect? I mean, is that that it just wasn't selling with that? It wasn't enough to make people want to spend $100 more?
It wasn't enough to make people spend $100 more. A lot of people are, you know, I mean, it's a giant camera in your living room, which is kind of off-putting to some people. The Kinect, It offers a lot of really cool features, especially for the Xbox One. It gives a whole level of voice control for the console, which is especially useful now that you can take your television, your cable box, and plug it straight into the Xbox. So, I mean, sitting here in my living room, I can tell my TV to just change the channel or control the volume, and it does it. But that's not necessarily something that everyone wants, especially not at that $100 price tag. So mm-hmm. it's been dropped to $399, and you know, this is one of the big things that Microsoft has needed to change for a while, especially since in some markets, Sony has been almost selling their PlayStation 4 2-to-1 to the
wow.
Xbox One. So it's been kind of a big deal.
So I was going to say, shareholders will be happy at this.
I think shareholders will be happy at this, and they've made a couple of other small changes to the Xbox Live digital setup, including a lot of the apps that were originally set up on the Xbox One, so that you had to have what they call an Xbox Live Gold subscription. Is no longer applicable. So if you have like Netflix or Hulu Plus or something like that you like to use through the Xbox, you now don't have to pay Microsoft for an Xbox Live subscription in order to use it.
Okay. We were going to, and we still will talk about cell phones and the charging of cell phones. There's a new charging device out there. It's called Legion Meter. Its makers claim that it will charge your devices up to 90% faster. It sounds too good to be true. Russell Holley, is that accurate?
Well, it's accurate in certain situations.
Okay.
We have a lot of really interesting kind of charging limitations depending on how we go to charge things today. And a lot of people in work environments, myself included, have lots of USB ports around them to plug in cables for smartphones and tablets. But a lot of people are not aware of is that, you know, not every USB port outputs at the same power meet. So, like, my laptop outputs at about half the rate of what, you know, something that I would have plugged into the wall would do. So it charges a lot slower when connected to a laptop, or I've even seen some people plug it into the front of their cable box where there's a USB port. It's just a convenient place to charge a phone. But those USB ports weren't really meant to charge phones, certainly not at that speed.
Mm-hmm.
And so this device, the Legion Meter, takes a lot of those environments and adjusts the output so that it'll end up charging your phone a whole lot faster.
Does it work with, then, any device, did you say?
It'll work with anything that uses a USB device to charge. So, I mean, your iPhone uses a USB cable. Almost every tablet and smartphone uses a USB cable.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it is just about everything as far as smartphones and tablets goes. But it's not, game consoles and things like that it wouldn't work with.
My guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a tech question for Russell, just on just about anything, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So with the Legion Meter, it has a built-in what they call a multimeter. What is that used for?
It gauges how much power is available and gives you that in a readout on the screen.
Okay.
In front of you so that you can see, you know, how much power is, you know, available to your device and how you can, you know, improve that or move on to another port if necessary. So the 90% number that they give you is really the demonstration that they give that for, where it's most applicable if it's, you know, plugged into the side of a laptop or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to understand that, you know, when you're drawing more power, it means that the battery on your laptop is going to not last as long. But
it
ends up being, you know, however you want that trade-off to happen. You know, if you're plugged in at a coffee shop or something like that, then obviously your goal is to get as much power to your phone as possible and move on. And the Legion Meter, in theory, will make that possible.
How much is battery life and the ability to charge up your battery, how much of a deal is that becoming? It seems like batteries aren't as much of an issue as they were just a few years ago.
Well, even just from last year, smartphone manufacturers over the last year have definitely figured out that, you know, battery life is one of the most important features. And so Apple, I don't think Apple even makes a device anymore that doesn't last more than or less than 10 hours on a single charge, unless you're using it in some extreme fashion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of these other manufacturers have put much larger batteries in the back of their phones and tablets. So it's somewhat less of an issue than it was a couple of years ago, but it's still,
mm-hmm.
You know, we're still having trouble getting past that 10 to 12 hour mark.
Right.
And a lot of us still remember having flip phones that would last, you know, 6 or 7 days on a single charge.
Mm-hmm.
And while we're not going to get back to that anytime soon, this is kind of a good stopgap.
Is that why the phones tend to be getting larger, is because of the batteries?
The battery is definitely a big thing, and screen size is also a big thing. It turns out that there are a lot of people watching videos and playing games on smartphones and tablets, and you know, the bigger the screen, the better that experience gets.
Is this available now, the Legion Meter?
This is not. This is actually part of a Kickstarter. They have several, you know, functioning prototypes so that they can, you know, they can show that this does in fact work. But they've set it up so that the Kickstarter starts at $50 for one of these, and they're shipping later this year.
Okay. The Parrot Bebop drone. You wanted to talk about that. There are pictures of the drone. It looks pretty small. Is this the kind of drone that we've been hearing about in the news? You know, some guy lost his drone, apparently, like his puppy or something out there was putting up signs. Is this the typical drone we're talking about?
Well, yes and no. Parrot has been making these kind of toys that connect to smartphones so that you can fly around and control that they have been calling drones for a couple of years now. They have the AR drone and the AR drone 2 that are these, you know, quadcopter machines that you pilot with a phone or a tablet. And they're a ton of fun, but they're a little on the expensive side. And this, the Bebop drone is kind of taking that one step further with a very high-definition camera, the ability to travel significantly further on a single charge, and a new controller that is basically a tablet with a lot of extra hardware on it.
The camera that you talked about, it doesn't have any moving parts. Does it move or does it turn around? How does that work?
So this is a 14-megapixel camera that has a fisheye lens on it, and it uses that to gain 180-degree view of, you know, everything that's immediately in front of it, and it uses software to allow you to pan around in that fisheye view. So you'll see, you know, kind of the rectangle right in front of you, but you can pan down and see what the bottom, you know, of that fisheye lens looks like. So it looks like, you know, from your perspective as the user, you're looking down when the drone isn't moving at all.
And it sounds like this drone is intended for personal use. This is what this company does, is make things for people to goof around with.
Yeah, their big thing is, you know, big toys for big kids, and they have a lot of these kind of smartphone controlled accessories that you know are designed to do exactly that. And that's something that they've been doing for a couple of years now. And I've used the AR drone. I haven't had a chance to use the Bebop yet, but they are a lot of fun to play with. You know, the previous units are right around $300, which is kind of expensive for a smartphone toy. It's, you know, for hobby, you know, drone enthusiasts or quadcopter, you know, flyers, it's interesting to see that there's kind of these two groups. When you hear the word drone, there's the group of people who are immediately security concerned, and there's a bunch of people who this is kind of their weekend hobby is to play with these.
Well, you mentioned, and you specifically mentioned hobby. There are, you know, the FCC, FAA, Aviation Administration, is already trying to restrict journalists and other commercial uses of drones. And there's talks about restrictions on hobbyists' drone use. But yet they're still able to market them to individuals at this point.
Yeah, this is still something that's going to continue to be, you know, kind of a hobby fun thing that you can take to the park. I mean, I can't. I live too close to an airport to fly one of these in my backyard without, you know, getting a nasty phone call or having someone pull up in my driveway. But mm-hmm. uh, it's it's one of those things where it ends up being a ton of fun in, you know, the appropriate places. And I think that as more and more people use these kind of devices, it's going to be the purview of groups like the FAA to make sure that, it stays, that they're just kind of basic rules about their use as entertainment devices.
It uses Oculus Rift, and we've talked about that before on the show. Can you remind us what that is? And then
sure.
Is it as if you're actually on the drone flying around yourself?
It is. So the Oculus Rift is a headset that you wear that has two displays that basically replaces your entire field of vision. You can't see anything at all that's not being presented to you by the display that's inside of this headset. And the controller that the Bebop comes with supports the Oculus Rift, which is interesting because the Oculus Rift isn't technically something you can go and buy on a store shelf yet. But the idea right now is that you'd be able to buy one of these and put it on, and your entire field of vision would be replaced by what the Bebop can see. So you would be flying around as this kind of out-of-body experience to be able to see what's going on there. And, you know, that obviously raises a couple of questions about, you know, what it is someone would use that for. But, you know, if you had the perspective,
right.
you know, to be able to you know, fly over a bay or, you know, to scale the side of a rock face or something like mm-hmm. that, it would be, you know, a very unique experience to be able to do something like that.
Yeah, that could be very cool. But as you said, Oculus Rift isn't available yet. It's just being made to be able to.
Right now it's in kind of a developer preview mode. It's hoping to, the guys at Oculus are hoping to have something that people would actually be able to buy and use later this year.
Okay. Google Maps, it's changed again.
Well, it's grown a few new features. It hasn't changed a whole lot.
Okay.
This is a really good thing for people who use Google Maps, specifically the turn-by-turn navigation functions in Google Maps. There was an update last week that added a ton of stuff. And if you're an Android user, it should have already rolled out to your phone. If you are an iPhone user, you can grab the updates just from the App Store. But turn-by-turn navigation now includes lane guidance. So when you're going down a multi-lane highway and you need to turn, it will actually tell you what lane you need to be in order to make the correct time. If you are stuck somewhere and you need to make a detour, or if a detour is available, it will actually give you several detour options and let you know which detour option is going to take the longest so that you can kind of plan in an intelligent way around. There's a lot of really kind of small usability features like that have been added to the service that are a really big deal.
Is it accurate? I mean, how do they...
I have used it for a couple of days now.
Okay.
And haven't had a problem with it so far. The detour system seems to work really well. It was definitely, you know, it told me that the detour was going to be 8 minutes, and it was right around 8 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
The lane guidance thing is a big deal for me because I'm not a particularly good driver, and so that has been a welcomed addition for me personally.
Yeah, the lane thing is getting to be an issue. It's like fine to make a right hand turn, but you don't know which lane to be in to make that turn off the expressway or wherever you're getting. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you just agreed with me. Agreed with me.
No, that's exactly how
okay.
that works.
Okay.
You described exactly how that works.
Okay.
it has an icon that gives you the lane that you want to be in, and so you glance down when it gives you the direction. It's either, you know, whatever lane, it'll be highlighted in green mm-hmm. in the list of lanes that are available.
Okay. And then you said there's a total visual overhaul with this update. So what is it?
Can you explain? The colors and everything are a little tiny bit different. It looks more, I guess, cel shaded would be the way to describe it. It has just a slightly different aesthetic to it. It doesn't change where any of the buttons are or anything, but it's the maps. This particular layout probably means that the maps can be drawn faster by the phone.
Okay.
So it'll be faster to do these kind of things.
All right. Well, Russell Holly, that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us as usual.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, he's a tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening today on Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.